warm welcome to this semester's Friday Anthropology Seminar Series. I'm going to send out a revised list next week because there's an extra one coming on February 1st. Fiona Ross, who is going to be examining Sana Hansen on the 4th of February, is going to be giving an additional seminar on the 3rd of February about the fetus. And I'll also be informing you about some of the other things going on, for instance, in the PhD seminar, we'll be having a couple of interesting events there, which you're all welcome to. But today, I'm delighted to introduce Roberta Rapaeta, who is based at CAF, Foscari University of Venice, and is the Deputy Director of the Centre for Environmental Humanities, which started recently. And is currently the PI for an ERC project called Health X-Cross. Health X-Cross. Part of which we'll be discussing today, I expect. So, Roberta has been working on a range of medical anthropology projects since 2006, beginning with work on the anthropology of allergies, with particular attention paid to what she calls medical pluralism, then expanding into health governance more widely and the policies of care for migrant groups in Italy, and another project on perinatal and infant death, and then the pandemic hit. The many years of research she's devoted to these topics then became extraordinarily important as the world scrambled to make sense of SARS-CoV-2 and the disease it causes, which eventually was named COVID-19, but not before most people became used to calling it the more generic coronavirus. That global event drew attention to the importance of not only understanding microbes, but also understanding the social, political, and epistemological conditions through which microbes are understood. And equally importantly, the importance of understanding difference, not only in terms of cultural or social differences, but also in terms of structural, legal, economic, technical, and perhaps particularly importantly, epistemological differences. The arrival of the concept of the microbiome within medical veterinary and ecological sciences might have profound effects on our understanding of ourselves in the world, and she will herself tell you more about her research on this today. My point is that Rapaeta's work is an example of why it's important to support academic research in the long term without knowing in advance what it might be for.
Yeah.
imagine. Thank you very much, Rapaeta, for coming in. The floor is yours. So with no further ado, I'm delighted to pass over to, and you haven't changed the title, thank you, Crossing Ecosystems, Crossing Ontologies, How Microbiome Science is Remaking What Does It Mean to Be Human? Thank you
very much. Thank you, Sarah, for this invitation. I'm delighted to be here and to meeting with all of you, really, in this beautiful city and this enlightened country. So thank you for being here. I just continue from the last sentence that Sarah said about the importance of sustaining academic interest despite whatever, because my interest in microbes that dates back to 2014. It was a time when microbes were not yet sexy and not yet under the public attention after COVID, right? So before COVID, I always had to explain lengthily why an anthropologist is interested in microbes. Nobody could understand it, right? But then after the pandemic, this connection became more clear in a way. People understood that microbes and biological realities are deeply connected with social and political realities. And So at the beginning, I was very marginal. I have to say, I like it also, my marginality in a way, but that was what gave me the great privilege to get that funding, the ERC funding, and then develop more my initial research. Yeah, so nobody would have bet on microbes, but then. So, my presentation today draws on the project, and in particular, I have to say, on a paper that I'm co-authoring right now with Hannah Landecker, who is a scholar at UCLA. The project, Health X-Cross, is a multi-sited comparative ethnography of how technoscience is reconfiguring practices and ideas of health by aggregating microbial data across time, space, and species. So this is what unites the different case studies we have in different continents. Maybe to not bother you too much with my voice, we take a small break and I show you a video we realized to explain what is the research questions and the topics, the approach we have in the project. If this is working. Maybe in the other mode was working, so I go back in the other mode.
Microbes are tiny living things that are found within, on, and around us, and are too small to be seen by the naked eye. The most common types are bacteria, viruses, and fungi. The human body is home to millions of these microbes, but they also live in animals, plants, water, soil, and in the air. Microbes are everywhere. Microbes are the connectors between us and the environment in which we live. Health is a concept usually associated with humans, but how can we rethink human health as part of an interconnected environment? Health X-Cross will explore the implications of approaching the planet as a body and the body as a planet. We are a team of anthropologists exploring laboratories where scientists analyze microbial data collected all around the world, derived from different samples from space, time, and species. This huge amount of data is then aggregated into a supercomputer in order to develop scenarios of health for both us humans and the environment. Anthropologists and scientists will collaborate to understand what it means to be human and to live on an interdependent planet.
So overall, this is the project idea, but I'm just at the beginning because the project has started in September 2021 and will end August 2026. So we are just at the beginning, and of course, I cannot do all these things alone. And I have a team of fantastic postdocs working with me, and two others will join soon. Each of them has a different case study. And just to briefly give you an idea of the overall project, we have three main research clusters. The first is called diversity. So we want to understand how scientists, exactly by these practices of aggregating microbial samples derived from very different origins, you know, they take samples from humans and non-humans, from plants, animals, air, ice, water, whatever, And then they aggregate all these samples into big supercomputers. And so what they want to do is to remake notions of biological diversities. And this explicitly says that they want to do it across conventional categorization of space, time, and species. So it's very intriguing. So as anthropologists, we want to look at how they do that, you know, and which is the vision that is leading them. And the second cluster is called space, well, and which is the vision and how this ontological reconfiguration also impacts on our own social scientists' ideas of what is ontology, right? And what is species, what is time, what is space, the time. The second cluster is called space time of innovation. And look how these innovation practices emerge from collaboration between the global north and global south, because when you want to map the planet, you have to have collaboration with different laboratories around the world. And also when you want to sample, you know, taking soil or water or human guts or whatever guts from other countries, then all where those samples come from, how you manage those relationships. So this speaks more to all the issue of data governance, right? And data governance and open data frameworks, because many times those are open data frameworks. And the last one refers to health. So how all these kind of research reshapes new trends in healthcare and health governance on the level of policies, but also of development of drugs, therapeutics, solutions, services, and whatever. So these are the three main clusters that are common in all different case studies. We have one case study in Europe, two in the US, one in the Pacific, one in North Africa, and one in China. So this is the overall project. And today I will focus on one specific issue that is also the issue that inspired the writing of the proposal. So I ask, what is the microbiome? It might sound as a stupid, you know, question. It's just necessary that you go on the internet or read a book of biology. But what I want to question is exactly its status as a scientific object. And so we in the project are analyzing how the microbiome is emerging as such in scientific practice. But before answering this question, and maybe I can go back. No, sorry. Maybe I can go back to the presentation mode now. Yeah. So before answering these questions, let's quickly see what microbes are. So microbes are incredible actors, atoms, or however we want to call them. We can find microbes in the clouds. We can find microbes in the deepest of the seas. And many of those things probably you know, because you have also this fantastic center here for the social study of microbes, and also Sarah is working on microbes, so probably I'm telling you something that you already know, but so apologize for that. But really, microbes, they thrive in many different environments, also in the ice, where I've discovered they are still living, but living in a dormant state for most of the year. Maybe in a year, they give a signal of life for a few hours, like, okay, like this, moving a bit. And as everybody says, there are more microbes in a spoon of soil than stars in the Milky Way, right? And our own gut is bigger than the outer space, is bigger than a cosmos, because you can think that in the Milky Way there are about 200 to 400 billions of stars, And in our gut, we have about 40,000 billions of microbes. So we have an entire universe in our body, right? Living with us and thriving with us, because microbes that do not just provoke diseases, but most of the time they are those agents that assure that we live in well-being. And so all these fabulous functions and activities of the microbes are usually quite popular and used in the narrative of One Health. One Health, you know, that wants to reconcile the health of the humans with the health of the environment. And also microbes are very, there are a number of studies that show how microbes became important for normative biopolitical forms. You know, if you think of biosecurity, you know, management of cross-border pathogens and like this. But also they are interesting agents of desired biopolitical forms, because the microbiome is reconfiguring the conventional idea we have about health. Health not being anymore just a property of one organism or one individual body or one individual organ within our bodies, but rather being a property emerging from a network of connections, right? And in these post-humanist and relational times, this sounds very well, right? So as social scientists, we are pretty much attracted and happy to jump on board of the microbiome agenda. The microbiome, and I witnessed conferences, microbiome conferences, in which microbiologists define themselves as the hearers of other great thinkers, as Copernico, who show that the Earth is not at the center, or Darwin, showing that the humans are not that exceptional, but they are just in the continuation of different other species, and is a general life force who is common among all species. And so they position themselves as the continuation of this intellectual adventure of dislocating the anthropocentric view. So as Paxons and Henrich, if you don't know well the debate about microbes and you want to know more, I suggest you to start from this article. It's one of my most favorites, brilliant articles. So the way it's written, right? It's very narrative. Anyway, Paxons and Henrich says that microbes are becoming models in prescriptive as well as descriptive ways. So they become models, they describe how life function, but also in prescriptive ways, because somehow they have such alluring features, right? That we really hope that is that way, right? We really hope that sociality is made of interconnections, of networks, of entanglements, and so on. So all this has driven a great deal of interest from scholars and the public alike. And this interest is helping to transform the social and scientific imagination of the human microbiome relationship. And in writing my own project, I was surely inspired by these debates. And also my initial interest surely was driven by these debates, right? But I also, more and more attending laboratories, I took a step back and started to ask whether it is perhaps premature to speak with confidence about the revolution that is the microbiome, as if it is already achieved, and as if we know already what its potentialities are and its impact. given that the concept of the microbiome is first of all the outcome of a technological revolution, as you can see, this is the decreasing cost of sequencing, right? Because we can understand, we can study the microbiome thanks to a sequencing technology. And we see a key year, 2007, right? 2007 is also dated the Human Microbiome Project. And I think it's not a coincidence. So in the project, we look at the microbiome as part of a data-driven science that is changing biology and biomedicine. So I think that what has not been considered in enough depth so far is the rather simple fact that we wouldn't have the microbiome without metagenomics. And what is metagenomics? The metagenomics is the technique, the methods through which scientists study the microbiome. So they collect samples, natural samples, think of sample of soil. They somehow purify it to get the DNA. They extract it, they fragment the DNA, and they need to fragment the DNA in order to sequence that. You know, to sequence means to read it, to know the letters that compose the DNA and in which sequence they come. And so they need, first they need to cut it, because otherwise they would be too large for the computer, to for the sequencer to read. And then, the sequencer does reconstruct this and somehow reassembles it through a very statistic logic practice, you know. So reading and rereading many times these fragments, they can reconstruct which was the entire sequence. And then once they have this, the scientists make different analyses. More or less, this is metagenomics. That means that the scientists working in the microbiome field, they do not study microbes, they don't play with microbes themselves. As I was telling today, I was a bit frustrated the first time I entered in the lab, because I was expecting those those scientists wearing the white coat and looking at the microscope, you know. No, I entered in a lab where there were about 10-15 people all staring at the screen on their desk, staring at these sequences for 8-10 hours a day. And I was stuck as an ethnographer, because then you say, what I look at, right? What do I do here? And I tried to tell something about that experience in a book. Sorry, I do not want to self-advertise, but somehow the book is just out since a few weeks. So, and here I tell a bit of those stories. But also, particularly, I try to go really deep into the details, mundane details of the practices of sequencing and making metagenomics. So, you know, what is then the microbiome? The microbiome is the ecological community of the microbes' genomes, not of the microbes. That is the microbiota. The microbiota is the ecological community of microbes, but the microbiome, this term that is so famous now, is this the collection of the different genes of a microbial samples, of a microbial community, right? And why it's so important? Because before sequencing, the only way we had to study microbes was to culture them in the petri dish. but we had to isolate them and to culture one by one. And in addition, we could culture only more or less 5% of the microbes that exist on the planet. So we were missing the great majority of the microbial diversity, right? So that's why metagenomics has been a great revolution, and in a sense has been a revolution, because we can see that it derives already from molecular biology, from the technology that was already there, right? And I want to say something else, but fine, don't remember. So when we speak about the microbiome, this is, you know, this computational digital signal. And therefore, I think that as anthropologists, in addition to considering the microbiome as a normative or a desired biopolitical form, we should also add the microbiome as a digital object, as a data-driven object, okay? And in the paper I'm developing with Hannah, we are trying to understand the impact of that onto very big notion on that of space and that of time. So we are in the middle of that, so I'm showing you a in-progress work, right? Heidegger asks, what is a thing? The question is quite old. What remains ever new about it is merely that it must be asked again and again. So we are doing that, right? Using ethnographic observation rather than beginning with philosophical modes of inquiry, we ask how scientific actors endow the microbiome with the aspects that allow us to colloquially and scientifically speak of it as a thing. So we look how do they iteratively parameterize this thing by feeding samples of the world into an assemblage of sequencers, mass spectrometers, computers, and software tools. And what role do the mapping and tracking functions of data collection and iteration in the form of the algorithm play in reorganizing how actors think of the microbiome as a space-time phenomenon? So the question of what is that we are studying when we study the microbiome, it appears to be quite paradoxical, because when we consider it as a computational process, because metagenomic is not simply a new way to better elaborate a given thing, it actually undoes the object even as it is represented. So undoes the microbiome at the same time it wants to define it. And I will show you ethnographically how. So the ability to say the microbiome is such an object is a series of decontextualization and recontextualization practices. In many ways, mine, it is an ethnography of a dissolving object in the midst of reconstruction. So I bring you with me in the lab, more or less. My case study in the wider architecture of the project is located in North America, in the United States, and specifically in a cutting-edge dry, because you know there is this differentiation within wet biology, that is what I was expecting initially, the microscopes, the petri dish, that is, and the dry biology, because more and more what I discovered in the years, more and more biology is made by the computational people, by informaticians. The most thriving labs in the world are led by people with a PhD in informatics, not in biology. In most cases, they have learned biology on the way. The most fortunate maybe had a degree also in biology. you know, but computational biology is transforming microbiome field, but it's transforming biology at large. So, and also this lab is located in a region which is very important, a biotech hub, right? And one of the first interviews I had with the PI of the lab that dates back 2018, he told me, Alan Kay, who was the developer of Smalltalk, the precursor of the graphical interface that is on your phone, he used to frequently say, the best way to predict the future is to invent it. And then he was very self-confident. He looked in my eyes and said, and that's what we are doing here. We are shaping what the future is going to look like by developing the underlying technologies that will make the future possible. And I thought, you are my man. And so let's see how they do that, what they do, and how we start with space, right? So this is a graphic from the Human Microbiome Project in 2012. They started to explore the great biodiversity of the planet by starting with the human body. And they could see, you know, fragmenting and sequencing the genome that we, of the genome of microbes, that our body hosts various microbes. Here there are names, and they divide each body size in different ways, right? But then somehow they also made a study of the functions of those microbes. And they saw that the identity of the microbes didn't match with the function. That means that this red guy here, placed here, might play a different role when it's placed here, right? Even if the name is same, they do different things in different places. And to better grasp that, then they changed the way they visualize, and they went for that, you know? And somehow, they looked like, they thought, oh, that's interesting, you know? You can differentiate different regions of the body, we're having different functions. But then looking at this, it really looks like a map of continents, right? And then, through the years, they also gather other data, because they also started, as I said, to map the world. They didn't just map body. And then what they did is that they saw that some microbes may be coming from an ecosystem very different from the mouth of a human, so a coral reef. Those microbes staying here are very, very similar to the microbes of the human's mouth. And so how do they describe that? They say we can take two communities and we can ask where on the planet you can find them. And so if we compare your mouth, for example, to a coral reef, you have these same complicated mineralized structures covering complex biofilms. The microbes from the mouth are as far away from the microbes in the gut as microbes from a coral reef off the coast of Florida are from the microbes in Kansas. So they are entirely non-overlapping microbial communities with essentially no similarity. And what this means is that a few feet along lines of your body can make just as much difference to microbial communities as thousands of miles across the Earth's surface. You know? So this is really posthumous, right? Really entangling. And they go on, and they add another technique, which is called metabolomics, that does not just look at the genes who are in the on a sample, but look at the molecules that are there, because that means, because the microbes speak to each other through to exchanging molecules. So they look at their interaction, and they integrate the metagenomic with the metabolomics, and they create these very artful and very nice to see clusters, you know, of differentiations. And those are the new biological clusters that they want to construct, as you were saying, as they say to me, across species, space, and time. So here, the coral reef is with the mouth, the prayer is with the human gut, and the human gut is more different than the human mouth than to the prayer. So are we a prayer or are we humans? I don't know. They don't care. They look at more at this, right? This implies that different parts of the body are totally different from one another microbially. I met with Sarah Green at EASA in Madrid, and you know, we were briefly speaking about the project, and she gave me two brilliant suggestions, you know, that really fit. And this derives from an article she wrote in a book entitled Locating the Mediterranean. And here, Sarah, you say, the taxonomic system is all about establishing similarities and differences that make a difference within the logic of linear taxonomy. That logic also draws stronger a certain understanding of location in its classification practices, particularly to concepts of indigeneity, habitat, and niche. And exactly this speaks to my case study, right? Because what they do is taxonomy, but they do it in a very different way than Linnean, right? They distantiate from that and distantiate also from embedding the taxonomy on a specific place. And Sarah goes on and she speaks about relative locations, where something is located relative to its connections to and disconnection from other locations, rather than identities, what something is as such. And this is exactly what is happening, right? So it made me think that also those scientists are developing, we can name it maybe relative taxonomies in a way, right? And, you know, we go back to what the scientists, how they describe these kind of things they are doing. Say, what's remarkable is that these patterns, when they say what's remarkable, they say with a tone like, what's fantastic, right? Is that these patterns automatically emerged from these patterns, we think back to the, you know, to the graphics. Emerged from an algorithm where there was nothing about the people, nothing about the samples. All in there is just similarities and differences in DNA of the different microbial samples. So these newly formed categories of biological differentiation rely on the statistical analysis of fragments of DNA abstracted from any information about the specific context in terms of species, space, or time from which they have sampled. And then what is, we can ask as anthropologists, what is space then? So space now in this new ontology, let's say, is proximate, but is also distant. It's visible thanks to big data processes, and it's visible at the interface of various methods. You know, these are very difficult names to spell, but they're all the different methods that I explain you. And the space is based on a radical deconceptualization beyond the conventional bisocial dimensions that we know. And so overall, we can say that the microbiome as a digital object rescales and also reorganizes the relation between bodies and their environment. You know, their environment, the space out there in which we are located. Sorry, I want to have a sense of the time.
It's 2:55.
Okay. And so now we turn to time. Are you ready? So they're not happy, they want to push forward, you know, they have to create the future. So they say the power of this kind of modeling approach to take a few samples and extrapolate from much larger spatial scales, whether it's our planet or whether it's our bodies, is immense. What we are starting to do is to take satellite image modeling data and then link that to the microbial assemblage prediction to figure out who is there, so which microbes are there, and then link that to a predictive herd service, predicting the turnover of different metabolites and then feeding that back into the climate models to understand how the microbes are changing their own environment and how that in turn will change the microbes again. So, and they say to do all this, you know, play between the scenarios of microbes and the scenarios of climate change, integrating them and predicting whatever. So, you know, the framework, model framework of whatever. So how time, what is time? So to grasp from this, we can see that to grasp the microbiome in the present is also to grasp the microbiome in the future. Because when you reduce the microbe into a digital signal, a DNA, a sequence, right, in a computer, then you can use it that to feed your software and create scenarios. And so, and the microbiome as a digital object emerge as made by repetitions. You know, in this sequencing, I told you, they can identify the microbes thanks to the millions of repetitions that the sequences operates on the biological signal. And an important aim of those people is to train computers to create microbiome scenarios. Because what usually they say is that their discoveries have a great amount of uncertainty, you know? They because of technical limitations, what they find out are approximations of reality. And this, I have to say, in the book I tell a little bit, creates also some psychological discomfort, especially in the junior scholars, you know, because once we were eating a pizza together and this guy, one of the most sensible, look at me and say, Roberta, but do you think that the things that we find out are real? And they say, you ask me, me, you should say, do you think are real? And then it started as a flood. He answered me, this is one of the main reasons why I go to the analysis, right? And then he connected all this to all his life and whatever. But this is true, you know, and also the wet biologists, when they criticize the computational people, they say you create artifacts, mm-hmm. You create computational artifacts. Those things doesn't exist, right? In reality, you do not know the biology behind. You just, you know, but so anyway, they say, okay, we create things that have a certain degree of arbitrariety, but That's important because we are training our machines. And so in the future, we will have better predictions, right? So the microbiome in the present is important because of the microbiome in the future somehow. And in the future, and also to create those scenarios. And somehow, you know, also there is this tension between the human and the environment, because as ever, there is the imperative of human health that is very present. And so somehow to me, but this is, I mean, in progress, right? So I'm in the field, I'm trying, my hypothesis really look, it seems to me that they are somehow exploiting the environmental data, they are mapping the planet in order to feed the guts, of human guts, right? Because they are exploiting environmental data, feeding the computer, and finally looking for solution for human guts or human whatever, right? For human health. So how is this tension between humans and environment played out in microbiome research? Which are the ethics, the politics implied. So I'm toward the conclusion. I had another very good suggestion from Sarah in Madrid, actually, that when I was trying to explain her, she said, oh, you know what? This really remind me of other two studies that are related to the microbiome. But then I went to look at it and that makes a lot of sense. You know, the first one is analysis of Facebook and says algorithmic data capture, although initially tied to an individual on Facebook, is made to work in ways independent of its source. You know, do you remember what's remarkable is that scenarios that samples are not connected. Independent of a person production, hence why we argue that we need to understand the overdetermination involved in value production. The use of Facebook is not a straightforward exchange of an individual's label for surplus value. Rather, data are partitioned, indexed, aggregated, and disconnected from the labor of its producer before it is sold in a myriad of different ways. It is also limited in many different ways as a commodity. So, you know, Facebook has nothing to do with microbiome, but they speak pretty much to each other, right? And also Sarah pointed to another study of the chain of pig production, and the same that we were saying today about the milk, you know, a part of the pig goes here, the other there, the other in a totally different country. At the end, we don't know where the pig is, but it's everywhere, right? So these are somehow new biopolitical space-time made also by the microbiome that in its philosophical premises looks so progressive, like so post-human, connecting each other, entangling the humans with non-humans. But it's so important to look at the real political agenda, and we can do that through ethnography, right? Not stopping ourselves the philosophy. And so to conclude, the only thing is that from these things, you know, face this microbiome, is somehow that the subject, the individual being humans or non-human, is transforming to bits. And when this process is done, what will be the impact, the consequences? So it's important to look at that. So to conclude, I think that it's important to look at the microbiome as a digital object for anyone who is interested in the microbiome. And because considering it as such opens new ways to consider and to understand its conceptual and social implications. Exactly because the microbiome as a digital object as a scientific object reorganizes space and time, knowledge and action. And I mean, I know that as humans, we always have dealt with microbes, right? And so there exist many other practices and many other knowledges about the microbes that not necessarily are these ones. And they're so important to study. So I think this kind of focus as complementary to the other one, and they should stay into dialogue. Because it's not only the scientific object of the microbiome that shapes our practices and our politics, but of course has a big influence. And what I find interesting to look at, and I hope this will be the, we will find out more in these next years in the project, is which kind of reorganizations of other social categories and processes are underway, you know? The idea of health, governance, what is a biomarker, what is a therapy, what is the environment, what is sociality, what is space, what time, what is research, what means to do research, and so on. And very importantly to me is how we as anthropologists can interact with this process. Because one of the ambitions of the project is not just to study the scientists, but also to intervene in their practices and collaborate with them. So that's all. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Lots of food for thought there. I think while people are gathering their thoughts and ideas, I'm just going to ask a short question. One of the things that strikes me when I come across these kinds of people as well in my own work is the degree to which the universal is taken for granted. However much diversity they're looking at, they're trying to find the human body. And yet, the image that you had there was a young white woman. And that the underlying epistemology still comes from 18th century Enlightenment thinking, which however post-human it might be in this case, is about finding knowledge that works irrespective of time and space, actually. That is independent of time and space. And that however much the borders are being restructured, and while you were talking, one of the other things is that there's been a reasonable amount of work in recent years has been topological thinking.
Yes.
That this idea of something that is a coral reef being connected in some way to, was it your mouth or your stomach?
Yeah, yeah.
That is as if they're in the same space. That's still an abstraction that raises it above and beyond actually time and space. So the question I have.
And is an abstraction that goes beyond time and space. So what the topological, or what they're doing?
Or what they're doing, which is a topological approach.
Exactly.
And if you're a contemporary mathematician that's interested in this stuff, they'd probably be very aware of that kind of topological manner. But the question is there any kind of potential challenging of that underlying universalist thinking that underlies, it seems to me, epistemologically, the whole project? That's one question. I have many others. I'll collect questions while you're answering.
Yeah, thank you. Sorry, any of you have a pen? Because I would like to take notes of your questions. Thank you so much.
And then I'll get another one.
Thank you. Yeah, what you are saying is exactly right. I mean, they have this universalist perception and perception, and also I reflected if this is topological or not. And in my thinking, it's not even topological, right? Because in topological space, somehow you see the you can reconstruct the relation, like. No, but we can.
Yeah, we can talk
to this
in the past.
Yeah, yeah, but I would like, because I'm grappling with this topological thinking since few days, but this is even different because they reduce to bits, and then the bits can go all directions without following a line. I was thinking about topological because recently I reread a paper from Ingold. Who was advocating for topological spaces, you know, but he works on lines. You can reconstruct the line. Here you can't, right? It's different. It rescales also the idea of what is a space that is non-linear, right? Anyway. There is a space for hope, you ask, of another. Yes, I think, and it's also what I try to convey in the book, you know, that, as I was saying this morning, I see those scientists in the middle of two cultural frameworks. One is science as ever. They can do these things thanks to molecular biology technologies. They have that framework. Many of them come from that education. They were not researching the microbiome. They were doing research in the genetic engineering of the, you know, whatever other cell. So they still have that. But at the same time, while if you study the microbiome, the same object you are studying imposes limits to you, imposes interferences to you, that you cannot ignore if you do good research. I give you an example. The other day there was a lab meeting, you know, of those labs, and they were doing a metabolomic study on different foods, and they were surprised by the fact that the peach juice was more similar to I don't remember, let's say chicken, then to the peach as a real fruit. They said, how that possibly be? And then somehow initially they tried to dismiss the answer, even the question. But then someone else went back, said no, you know, and they started to speculate, well, that's because of depends on how you rise the peach, which is the soil of that peach, and then what you do with that peach, how do you process it? The juice has inside lots of additives, and probably that's what really matters, not if it's peach or chicken or framboise, and how you say strawberry. And they were like, oh, but then locality matter, and they started to, you know, they started to. And someone else say, no, but just shut up. These are just too complex. You know, we have to go on. We have to conquer the world. So we just go on. And the other were like, but you know. You know, though. Or like this other actor, a character of the lab that I told you, asked me if I believe in reality. And sometimes he has really much crisis and he bring me apart. And he looks and say, you know, Roberta, when I was young, I wanted to save the world. And now, but then I decided the easiest way, I became a scientist with computers, which is very trendy and very well paid. Mm-hmm. My other friends made biology, and now they have no money, but they're happy. They're fighting for saving bees, you know? And then because doing something that doesn't, but still I want to do that, you know? So there are a mixture of scientists, there are mixed scientists, and the materiality of microbiome is somehow posing limits to themselves, and there is confronting them with challenges that they didn't have in classical molecular biology.
All right, so yes, so in a way they are finding, at least coming across the problems that are implied, not the solutions. Yeah. I've got a list of people starting to ask questions. So that's, so first, Anne, followed by someone, and Dino.
Thank you. Thanks very much. I found this your argument or your point about the reorganization of time space very interesting, but of course I'm going to ask about something else. And but connected, because it's not only reorganizing the time space, but also reorganizing or forging relationships through this like classification of difference and similarity, as far as I understood this. And this kind of connects to my very limited reading on microbiomes, which is pretty much one article. and it was about, it was very much focused on these relationships, how microbiomes are creating relationships or shaping relationships, in particular in relation to kind of human sociality from evolutionary perspective. So because it's beneficial to have this long-term, continuous, repetitive, intimate interactions with the same individuals, because then we, if we get depleted, we kind of fill in from the other person's microbiome and so on. So this is beneficial for human health. So in that way, microbiomes have been very central to like evolution of human sociality.
Yes.
So from in your project, could you say a bit more about this, how the microbiomes or the way that they are being studied is reorganizing relationships?
Yes, thanks. I would like to tell you a lot. The fact is that I don't know much, but the fact that I don't know much is that I don't know much. You know, there is an important scientist, Rob Knight, who is sequencing his fecal material since many years every single day, and he couldn't yet understand the pattern, you know. Well, there are of course some interferences. There are studies that prove, for example, that my microbiome is very similar to that of my pet, for example, or that from other, you know, people in the household. But to really establish you know, how these interferences are created and stabilized, first of all, also in the field of nutrition, is very, very difficult. So they are trying to better understand. There are some interferences, but because the humans especially are so complex, it's very difficult to establish. For example, there are many studies about urban population and versus traditional non-westernized people, right? To see if the relationship, the sociality that people have in more traditional place create a different microbiome than the urban one. But also there to establish what is a urban place or a westernized lifestyle is very difficult. There is a very nice article last year written by a microbiome scientist really making more complex this differentiation. You can live in an urban setting but ferment your own, making your own bread, having your own garden with your veggies, or vice versa. It's really decomposed in many different ways. I don't know if it was satisfying.
Thank you very much. And
apologies
for not being in advance.
Oh, no, she's rather is welcome.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the talk. I'm super happy to hear about your work, and you're always welcome to do amazing given the overlap. Fascinating to hear about early research and really look forward to forward to hearing more about the case studies and your findings. No, we had a very generous 2 hours before this, so I know that you're comfortable with me asking this question, which is that, well, here's, take this as an invitation to talk about the kind of the critical edge of critical angle to microbiome research. For example, thinking of the normativity about our skin and vaginal births that are developing with this new research, the totalization of Western biomicrobiomes as the key while mining indigenous people's microbiomes in order to have new pharmacological microbial solutions for better health. The myriad of ways in which microbiome research is creating inequalities and injustices and reinforcing certain kinds of normativities.
Yeah.
And I invite you with this this comment to talk openly about what you think about those and pick any examples that you fancy. But like, what are the risks and challenges and fears of this harm?
No, thanks.
My child was terrified.
So no, yeah, thank you. And this is, you know, the concern that drove me to continue research on the microbiome, because I saw many potentialities in the microbiome paradigm, but there are also many risks in a way. And still I'm quite optimistic in a way that I think there is value and it is worth it to try to collaborate with scientists. When I tried, you know, I speak with them about my criticism. You know, you have to find the right timing and the right moment and the right words. But most of the time they welcome the criticism. So, and I think if we want to change something, we have to work with them, not just staying in our offices, in our department, and criticizing them in written papers. But there are plenty of examples. You gave some of them, you know. One of the first times that I entered in the lab, Nicola, who is the PI of the lab, not this lab that I show, another one in Italy that is the one that is in the book. He was very proud because, as I said this morning, he misunderstood me. He thought I'm a physical anthropologist. That's why he accepted me in the lab at the beginning, right? So as I said this morning, it was a mixture of failed expectation. I thought they had the microscope. They thought I'm a physical anthropologist, a mess. But then he came to me all proud and say, oh, look, this article just came out. It's a very good one with anthropology too. And the title was The Gut Microbiome of Uncontacted Amerindians, 2015. And it was, wow, uncontacted Amerindians in 2015. Let's have a look who they are. They were the Yanomami.
Oh my
goodness. You know? Yeah. So I said, Nicola, come with Robbie here, I show you something. And I show him the cover of all the books, taking Yanomami as the typical example of exploitation both from life sciences and social sciences. And he was embarrassed. He turned red. And he understood that maybe he needed a cultural anthropologist instead of a physical anthropologist working with him, right? But I mean, it's full of these things. And but I see, as I was telling this morning, I see the field changing so quickly, so quickly. Recently, always this Nicola called me to help them with the review. There was a review of one of their papers really pointing to the fact of mining for indigeneity and really asking details about that necessity, asking details for all the implications. That review was brilliant. I think was written by a biologist, but he or she had also a strong competency of our discipline. It was a beautiful one, you know, and they were challenged. They had to go through that. They had to change the paper. They had to rethink their process. So yes, there are many risks, but I see a lot of work can be done. And as I was telling you, the microbiome opened the possibility for this change and transformation.
What you're pointing to is that the social, the historical, and the political still isn't allowed in very easily.
No.
Which gives you the question about who's it for and what's it for. Having the curiosity, I've worked with a lot of pure mathematicians, for instance, who are just curious, how can you make this work mathematically?
Yeah.
But then they don't ask actually who for.
Yeah,
and it's an important question.
Yeah, that's why we have the cluster health, because we want to understand who is for. Mm-hmm. It's for the environment. It's for who? It's for humans. It's for specific humans.
Thank you. It was super interesting, and I have some help. I learned a lot of new things. One thing that rang a bell for me was your comparison, your example of how the microbiome is located in different places in the human body and on Earth. And it kind of made me think about what Alexander von Humboldt did when he was inventing the concept of nature, because he was like climbing a mountain and making notes about the different plants growing on that mountain, and then invented the idea that the whole Earth could be divided in vegetation zones. And so, like, you know, it seems like any time you claim that there is a thing that you are studying, like nature or microbiome, you have to scale up and you need these spatial concepts in order to do that. And the end result seems to be, at least in Humboldt's case, that you end up with like the idea of some like stable system somewhere, located somewhere, where things are in some kind of balance or harmony. And when it went on to the topic of time, it seems like you were saying something different, that possibly, maybe, like if we think about the COVID epidemic, it's not really the same thing anymore as it was like 2 years ago, right? So like the microbiome is itself causing that change in some way. It seems that that's maybe a way to transcend earlier categories of knowledge. But do you think that's true, or do you think that's the ambition?
What do you mean, if I think it's true, what?
If it's true that the research that aims at discovering microbiomes and calculating the probabilities of them like being located in some site.
No, yes, yeah, no, yes. Thank you for this question. No, they're already changing. And also these things of the scenarios that I show you, it's real. I mean, they really did it. They really said that those things. But then that was some years ago. And I propose you to give you some food for thought, right? But in the bigger narrative is that they made some steps back, you know? They understood that was too much. They tried, they saw that the paper were rejected, that they couldn't find really rigorous science, and they made some steps back. And also that's why now they're integrating more and more the metabolomics as well, so to really see what's happening. And in general, the trend, what I'm witnessing in the last years, is more and more to resort also to create alliances with clinical people, to integrate the microbiome with in vitro studies, so to connect the mathematical speculation with what really is happening, and also to connect it with the materiality, you know, and the context. So I think overall in the field there is some stepping back and say, look, we have to look more for the context, we have to look more for materiality. That's also why I'm kind of optimistic, say, you know, there is the materiality hitting back to them.
Yeah.
you know. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you again. My question was already asked, but I'll maybe phrase it in a different way, which is that there seems to be a slippage between the word microbiota and microbiome. See. And that there's, you know, a synonymization when they are not the same thing,
yeah.
Right? That in the same way, nothing about this is people, right? Nothing about this is about microbes, right? It's
yeah.
about a computational artifact, as
yeah.
you say. And so I see, and it's very convincing, that sort of individual to bits decontextualization. And
yeah.
even now I hear you talking about the materiality and the recontextualizing part of
yeah.
it, putting it back, has a very prescriptive slope,
yeah.
you know, or threat to go down a very prescriptive or universalizing path.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering how much of it maybe stems from that slippage of microbiota to microbiome.
Yeah.
That, you know, do we need to give it a different name? Like, I know obviously that's not going to help or cure anything or
yeah.
solve anything, but, you know, like,
yeah.
one is numbers, an ATCG, and
yeah.
another is a set of practices, organisms, history,
sure.
source, all of that.
Yeah. Thank you very much, but this gap is very present in the lab as well,
okay.
you know? I mean, they are staring at the screen 8 hours, and on their desk, they have a peluche of microbes, you know? The little peluche, or each of the scientists have at least a couple of them. Or they have the cup with the microbes, and there's the posters, they are the puppets, you know? So this is a detail, it's an ethnographic detail. One of these little things you can see or not see. But for us it's important to look at the details, you know. Somehow it's like if they somehow forget about the slippage
yep.
themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
So the public, you can imagine, right?
Yeah.
So but they already somehow have this, the pet microbes, or I wanted to give you other examples. There are some other examples I had in mind that I don't remember. But, and then the doubt come in the Paolo would tell me if I believe them, but he considered the strange one in the group, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because he remembers about the artifact nature of what they are doing. So, yeah.
I guess it's a good thing that they're questioning it all, and that Facebook example, they're just mm-hmm. creating the realities and
yeah.
making money out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting comparison, the one with the Facebook
yeah.
Disambiguation of the person into data,
mm-hmm.
and then recreating a new reality that you can then use to make it work, which is different from what people who are doing the microbiome are doing. But as you pointed out, the process is very similar, and therefore it probably is worth thinking through the kinds of realities they're creating, which is why it's good
yeah.
that you're doing that project.
Just wanted to just add to that point. I think one of the concerns that I have is a lot of what I'm seeing is I really enjoyed your talk, thank you, because it's also, I've got a paper that's been stuck in the review process for about a year. Apparently the reviews are going to come back, and this is, I know it's going to want to be rewritten, and this will help. But part of it is this decontextualization and recontextualization again, and, you know, thinking about the Facebook, the digital model, you know, recreating the human, is that it's also, you know, creating people, you know, populations in geographical areas. So you've got the kind of the racialized aspect of it coming on, because then, of course, certain populations are labeled as risky because of their microbiome profiles as a digital
yeah.
object, completely without considering this kind of, you know, the relationships from which their microbiome may have been created, and just assuming there's that kind of assumption that they must be doing something wrong, or, you know, that not so much that they, no, actually that's probably my polemic to say it that way, but more that this is population or an area or a geography or something that needs to be intervened upon, yes, in order to protect,
yeah,
and restore.
Yeah.
To protect what? To protect the people or?
I could be cynical there as well, but yeah, I think just at the moment to protect, and you can leave that open to,
okay,
what you want to insert in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, definitely is another tool to the biopower, right?
Yes.
And but again, I invite you to, do you have something to write here or? I really invite you to write, to read this paper. Oh, but I'm so sorry to spoil it just for one paper.
Yes,
please.
Finish coming.
The age might be some other place, maybe. With 2000, and it might be one or two, not sure. Sana Kutiar and Aspen Rees, they are two microbiome scientists, and they, Sana, she is an early postdoctor, she just finished her PhD, she's from Sri Lanka, and studying in the microbiome field, she was first to say, hey, wait, I live in a city in Sri Lanka, but I have monkeys in my city.
Yeah.
So how, you know, she was going to problematize these easy differentiations between urban and non-urban places, right? And these papers come in a collection of other paper, a special issue organized by a microbiome scientist about the ethical implications of microbiome. Because there are some of those special issues that are written by us, right? I was one of them, but I mean, we social scientists. It's interesting, and I think it's not a coincidence that it's coming from microbiome people instead than cell biology, right? As I told you, because the microbiome bring you face to face with the material conditions, even if you try initially to ignore it.
Yeah.
And also she also is a great woman, and she said that she gave many examples to me about how, you know, there is this trend of, oh, we have to find the good microbes that then we put in the probiotic formula for all the world. And she said, okay, she gave me a specific example of microbes who work very well in a specific population because they have certain conditions, their ecological and social conditions. But then it could even harm in other conditions, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, the field is evolving.
Thanks very much. My question, I'm Eva Varela. I teach designers as an anthropologist in an institution that's basically engineers, business people, and arts.
Yeah.
So a completely different intellectual space. And my question really comes from my own curiosity. I mean, I've learned so much today, it's amazing. But my curiosity, and then maybe where I'd like to hear something from you, is the academic politics underpinning this, because it sounds like the kind of work that you're discussing is not necessarily confined to an academic university setting. I was really fascinated by the image you showed of the cost of doing this kind of work, and what is it these days expensive to do in terms of intellectual production, and what is cheap? And I don't know, that might be a sort of different question. But I was also wondering whether you are identifying, or whether you've hinted at some of the answers, I think, and maybe the answer is that nobody knows, but where are we going kind of internationally? Are we going towards some kind of fragmentation or some kind of actual, possibly slightly contradiction to what you've been suggesting, that there are actually
actually contextual factors at play when it comes to academic work in this area, which come from political commitments of those people who fund university work, or let's say NGOs or organizations, and you know, your Sri Lanka example, it just makes the mind boggle, and in some ways is incredible, you know, is a great injection of optimism. I think because as somebody who doesn't work at all with sort of actual science, I can't, you know, I'm still stuck in that epistemology where, of course, this, you know, it may be, you know, you may have a discussion with a guy about whether this is real, but in some very relevant sense, of course it's real, and it will affect all our lives.
Exactly.
So I guess I'm just asking, could you, do you think ever about the connections to the intellectual policy, the academic, financial side, the digitalization, you know, it's a digital artifact, and Argot would, I imagine, sort of recognize this.
Yeah, no, thank you for your question. Absolutely, and that's not a chance that here
kind of organization research to write, because this is at the core.
And we see this data infiltration into many other disciplines in our too. So I had to compile the data management plan of my project. It was a big challenge. It took a lot of energy and time, and some people just say, yeah, but you answer yes, so they happy, you know? Yeah, I answer yes, and they say, I comply with all. I took a lot of time because many questions said no, you know, and explain why, because data in anthropology are not the same than life sciences. But this data-driven research is infiltrating in many different at many different levels, many different disciplines, many different protocols. And so a project like this, I hope, can also say something about how we do research. There is the first postdoc working with me, Lucilla Barchetta. She started last year, and she's doing research about open data platform of One Health. Lucilla, this one. You know, One Health is this idea of studying how human health. So that means that many disciplines are interacting, right? And this idea, they could build this digital framework to put data coming from veterinary science, environmental science, biology, many different strands of. And they think, okay, we just take the data, we aggregate in a supercomputer, and then we get answers, right? And she's studying the failure of this idea, right? But then she's also studying why it fails. And it fails because you can, I mean, behind the data, behind, inside, around, there are social words, you know? And if you don't make them enter into a genuine dialogue, the data themselves doesn't do anything, right? So, I hope this kind of project can help more and more to resist this infiltration of data dogmatism in all the sciences, and also this kind of science that goes quicker and quicker, always accelerates, and in this idea of production, and that is not a chance that they said is so good, is surprising in a good way that all is abstracted, no? Because if you have bits, then you can assemble, reassemble, and produce. And you said, Sarah, who is for? In that optic is also for personalized medicine, you know? Personalized medicine looks like another good thing, but it might be also a very dark thing, you know? So, but still, I'm sorry, I'm optimistic. I still also see that this is like the other day I was seeing some Twitter from some scientist I'm following. He was retweeting another article exactly claiming that we should change our system of research. We cannot be, we it should not be priced just by the number of papers we publish or how big is our data set or things like that. And those scientists, he reposted it, and then in the interaction with others, he said, yes, I don't have any more time to think, and I want to reclaim it, and I want to reclaim it back. I was surprised, you know, that he said something like this. But we are, maybe everybody is really exhausted. I think also we are reaching a tipping point, I think. I don't know.
That's probably a good point. Stop. There's a lot to be said in the pub about that. I haven't made use of it, as I think people know. But just to thank you once again for taking us